listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So I had such a pleasing assignment this morning to read, sit down and just read Laurie Moore stories, which was great, from her new collection, Bark, where I found such uncannily precise descriptions of sort of crevices of consciousness. I found myself marveling again and again that some phenomenon or emotion that I thought was so idiosyncratic could have plausibly been experienced by another human being, and then that it had been described with such precision, and I kept gasping and laughing with astonishment. In Debarking, the first story in this new collection, we return to that nightmare moment on the eve of the U.S. bombing of Baghdad. We all remember, shock and awe. A divorced man driving home from a date gone bad finds himself honking in solidarity with protesters on the sidewalk in, as Laurie Moore writes, a wild chorus of futility that seems, quote, for all its stupidity and solipsism and scenic civic grief, something like a gorgeous moment, unquote. Yes, in those few words, Laurie Moore captures a terrifying truth. Laurie Moore grew up in a tiny town in the Adirondack foothills. In an interview, she notes that her parents were members of an amateur operetta club and how at Sunday rehearsals from an early age, she loved watching those grown-ups, quote, fall in and out of character or burst into song or laughter. And as a writer, she's become a connoisseur of another kind of theater, one that is on vivid display in her stories, what she calls, quote, the makeshift theater that springs up between people at really awkward times, times of collision, emergency, surrealism, aftermath, disorientation. She received her MFA in writing at Cornell and published Self-Help, her first collection of short stories, in 1985 to great critical acclaim. Her other story collections are Like Life and Birds of America, and her novels are Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, Anagrams, and A Gate at the Stairs. She is a recipient of the National Book Critics Circle Award and many other honors. For the last three decades, she taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as the Delmore Schwartz Professor in the Humanities, and she was recently named Gertrude Conaway Vanderbilt Professor of English at Vanderbilt University. She's moved to Tennessee. And in conversation with Laurie Moore tonight is Bridget Mullins, a playwright whose works include The Bourgeois Pig, Monkey in the Middle, Fire Eater and others. And I just read one of her excellent plays, Those Who Can Do, a black comedy, which shares a mordant wit, I might suggest, with Laurie Moore's fiction. Her plays have been produced around the United States, and she currently teaches in the Master Professional Writing Program at USC. And I want to mention that next month we'll be hearing from 10 writers from five of LA's different MFA programs, including USC. It's the first time we've hosted such a reading. It will include Otis and CalArts and UC Irvine and UC Riverside. So please join us to hear some great writers at the beginning of their careers. But right now, please join me in welcoming Laurie Moore and Bridget Mullins. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Louise. That was great. Very kind, very generous naming awards. I didn't actually win. But we won't say anything. We'll just keep it between us. I'm going to read a short story that is set in 2008, which I thought of as a very thrilling year. I still think it was a thrilling year, and, you know, if I had to pick one year and had a time machine, I'd go back to 2008. Even if the economy did collapse, oh well. This is called Foes. Okay. Bake McCurdy was no stranger to the parasitic mixings of art and commerce, literature and the rich. Hedge funds and haiku, he'd exclaimed to his wife, Susie. and yet such mixing seemed never to lose their swift, stark capacity to appall. The hustle for money met the hustle for virtue, and everyone washed their hands in one another. It was a common enough thing, though was there ever enough soap to cut the grease? That's what your lemon is for, Susie would say, pointing at the twist in the martini he was not supposed to drink. Still, now and again, looking up between the crab meat cocktail and the palate-cleansing sorbet sprinkled with fennel pollen dust, he felt shocked by the whole thing. It's symbiosis, said Susie, as they were getting dressed to go. Think of it being like the krill that grooms and sees for the rock shrimp, or that bird who picks out the bugs from the rhino hide. So we're the seeing eye krill, he said. Yes, said Susie. We're the oxpeckers, he said. Well, I wasn't going to say that, she said. A lot in this world has to do with bugs, said Bake. Food, Susie said. A lot has to do with grooming and food. Are you wearing that? What's wrong with it, he asked. Lose the, what are those? Suspenders. They're red, she said. Okay, but you know, I never do that to you, he said. I'm the sighted krill, she said. She smoothed his hair, which had recently become a weird pom-pom of silver and maize. And I'm the blind boy? Well, I wasn't going to say that either, she said. You look good, he said, whatever it is you're wearing. See, I say nice things to you. It's a sarong. She tugged it up a little. Bake ripped off his suspenders. Well, here, you may need these. They were staying at a Georgetown B&B to save a little money, a townhouse where the owner couple left warm cookies at everyone's door at night to compensate for their loud toddler who by 6 a.m. was barking orders and pointing at her mother to fetch this toy or that. After a day of sightseeing, all those museums prepaid with income taxes, it was like being philanthropists come to investigate the look of their own money. Susie and Bake were already tired. They hailed a cab and recited the address of the event to the cabbie, who nodded and said ominously, "Oh, yes. Never mind good taste. Here at this gala, even the usual diaphanous veneer of seemliness had been tossed to the trade winds. The fundraiser for Lunar Lines Literary Journal, 3LJ as it was known to its readers and contributors, the magazine as it was known to its staff, as if there were no others, was being held in a bank, or at least a former bank, one which had recently gone under and which now sold squid ink or Chieti beneath its vaulted ceilings and martinis and Grenache from its former teller stations. Wood and marble were preserved and buffed, glass barriers removed. In the evening light, the place was golden. It was cute. So what if subtle boundaries of occasion and transaction had been given up on? So what if this were a mausoleum of greed now danced in by all? He and Susie had been invited. The passive voice could always be used to obscure blame. The invitation, however, to this DC fundraiser seemed to Bake a bit of a fluke, since Man on a Quarter, Man on a Horse, his ill-selling biography of George Washington, in a year when everyone was obsessed with Lincoln, even the efficiently conflated President's Day had failed to help his book sales, would appear to fit him to neither category of guest. But Lunar Lines, whose offices were in Washington, had excerpted a portion of it as if in celebration of their town. And so Bake was sent 2 free dinner tickets. He would have to rub elbows and charm the other guests, the rich, the magazine's donors, who would be paying $500 a plate. Could he manage that? Could he be the court jester, the town clown, the token writer at the table? Absolutely, he lied. Why had he come? Though it was named after the man he had devoted years of affectionate thought and research to, he never had liked this city, an ostentatious company town built on a marsh, a mammoth, pompous, chit-ridden motor vehicle department run by gladiators, high-level clerks on the take, their heads full of unsound sound bites and falsified recall. Yes, how are you? It's been a while. Not even, it's been a long time, because who knew, perhaps it hadn't been. Better just to say neutrally, it's been a while, and no one could argue. He clung to Susie. At least the wine is good, she said. They weren't really mingling. They were doing something that was more like a stiff list, a drift and sway. The acoustics made it impossible to speak normally, and so they found themselves shouting inanities at each other, then just falling mute. The noise of the place was deafening as a sea, and the booming heartiness of others seemed to drown all possibility of happiness for themselves. Soon we'll have to find our table, he shouted, glancing out at the vast room filled with 100 white clothed circles flickering with candlelight. Small vases of heather sprigs that could easily catch fire had been placed in the centers as well. So were little chrome card holders declaring the table numbers. What number are we? Susie pulled the tag from what he facetiously called her darling little bag, then shoved it back in. 79, she said. I hope that's near the restroom. I hope it's near the exit, he said. Let's make a dash for it now, she said. Let's scream fire, he added. Let's fake heart attacks, she said. Do you have any pot, he asked. We flew here, remember? I wouldn't bring pot on an airplane. We're losing our sense of adventure in all things. This is an adventure. You see, that's what I mean. At the ringing of a small bell, everyone was to sit, not just the ones already in wheelchairs. Bake let Susie lead as they wended their way, drinks in hand, between the dozens of tables that were between them and number 79. They were the first ones there, and when he looked at the place cards and saw that someone had placed Susie far away from him, he quickly switched the seating arrangements and placed her next to him on his left. I didn't come this far not to sit next to you, he said. And she smiled wanly, squeezing his hand. These kinds of gestures were necessary, since they had not had sex in 6 months. I'm 60 and I'm on antidepressants, Bake had said when Susie had once, why only once, complained. I'm lucky, he added, that my penis hasn't dropped off. They remained standing by their seats, waiting for their table to fill up. Soon a young investor couple from Wall Street who had not yet lost their jobs, then a sculptor and her son, then an editorial assistant from 3LJ. Then last, to claim the seat to his right, a brisk young Asian woman in tapping heels. She thrust her hand out to greet him. Her nails were long and painted white. Perhaps they were fake. Susie would know, though Susie was now sitting down and talking to the sculptor next to her. I'm Linda Santo, the woman to his right said, smiling. Her hair was black and shiny and long enough so that with a toss of the head she could swing it back behind her shoulder, and short enough that it would fall quickly forward again. She was wearing a navy blue satin dress and a string of pearls. The red shawl she had wrapped over her shoulder she now placed on the back of her seat. He felt a small stirring in him. He had always been attracted to Asian women, though he knew he mustn't ever mention this to Susie, or to anyone, really. I'm Baker McCurdy, he said, shaking her hand. Baker? She repeated. I usually go by Bake, he said. He accidentally gave her a wink. One had to be very stable to wink at a person and not frighten them. Bake? She looked a little horrified, if one could be horrified only a little. She was somehow aghast, and so he pulled out her chair to show her that he was harmless. No sooner were they seated than appetizers zoomed in, tomatoes stuffed with avocados and avocados with tomatoes. It was a witticism with a Christmassy look, though Christmas was a long way away. So, where are all the writers? Linda Santo asked him while looking over both her shoulders. The shiny hair flew. I was told there would be writers here, she said. You're not a writer? Asked Bake. No, I'm an evil lobbyist, she said, grinning slightly. Are you a writer? In a manner of speaking, I suppose, he said. You are? She brightened. What might you have written? What might I have written, or what did I actually write? Either one, she said. He cleared his throat. I've written several biographies, Boy George, King George, and now George Washington. That's my most recent, a biography of George Washington, a captivating man really with a tremendous knack for real estate and a peevishness about being overlooked for promotion when he served in the British Army, the things that will start a war. And I'm not like his other biographers. I don't rule out his being gay. You're a biographer of George's, she said, nodding and unmoved. Clearly, she'd been hoping for Don DeLillo. This provoked him. He veered off into a demented heat. Actually, I've won the Nobel Prize, he said. Really? Yes, but, well, I won it during a year when the media weren't paying a lot of attention. So it kind of got lost in the shuffle, he said. I won right after 9/11, in the shadow of 9/11. Actually, I won right as the second tower was being hit. She scowled. The Nobel Prize for Literature? Oh, for literature? No, not for literature. His penis now sat soft as a shrinking peach in his pants. Susie leaned in on his left and spoke across Bake's plate to Linda. Is he bothering you? If he bothers you, just let me know. I'm Susie. She pulled her hand out of her lap and the two women shook hands over his avocado. He could see Linda's nails were fake, or if not fake, something. They resembled talons. This is Linda, said Bake. She's an evil lobbyist. Really, Susie said good-naturedly. But soon the sculptor was tapping her on the arm, and she had to turn back and be introduced to the sculptor's son. Is it hard being a lobbyist? Asked Bake. It's interesting, she said. It's hard work, but interesting. That's the best kind, he said. Where are you from? She asked. Chicago. Oh, really, she said, as if he had announced his close connection to Al Capone. Anyone he ever mentioned Chicago to always brought up Capone, either Capone or the Cubs. So you know the presidential candidate for the Democrats. Brocco, love him, said Bake. He's the great new thing. He's a writer himself. I wonder if he's here. Now Baker, as if in mimicry, turned and looked over both of his shoulders. He's probably out with his terrorist friends, Linda said. He has terrorist friends? Bake himself had a terrorist friend. Midwesterners loved their terrorist friends, who were usually fine and boring citizens, still mythically dining out on the sins of long-ago youth. They never actually killed anyone, at least not intentionally. They aged and fattened in the ordinary fashion. They were rehabilitated. They served their time, and, well, if they didn't, because of infuriating class privilege that allowed them to just go on as if nothing had ever happened, well, they raised each other's children and got advanced degrees and gave back to society in other ways, he supposed. He didn't really know much about Chicago. He was actually from Michigan. But when going anywhere, he always flew out of O'Hare. Yeah, that bomber who tried to blow up federal buildings right here in this town, said Linda. When Brocco was a kid, that 60s guy, but Brocco doesn't even like the 60s. He thinks they're so 60s. The 60s took his mother on some wild ride away from him. The 60s made him, my friend. Bake looked at her more closely. Now he could see she wasn't Asian. She had simply had some kind of plastic surgery. Skin was stretched and draped strangely around her eyes, a botched eye job, a bad facelift, an acid peel, whatever it was, Susie would know exactly. Well, he was a young child, said Baker. So he says. Is there some dispute about his age? Where is his birth certificate? I have no idea, said Bake. I have no idea where my own is. Here is my real problem, said Linda Santo. This country was founded by and continues to be held together by people who have worked very hard to get where they are. Bake shrugged and wagged his head around. Now would not be the time to speak of timing. It would be unlucky to speak of luck. Could he speak of people having things they didn't deserve in a room full of such people? She continued. And if you don't understand that, my friend, then we cannot continue this conversation. The sudden way in which the whole possibility of communication was now on the line startled him. I see you've researched the founding of this country, he said. He would look for common ground. Yes, she said, I watched John Adams on HBO every single episode. And wasn't the guy who played George Washington uncanny, said Bake? I did think Jefferson looked distractingly like Martin Amis. I wonder if Martin is here. He looked over his shoulders again. He needed Martin Amis to get over here right now and help him. Linda looked at him fiercely. It was a great miniseries and a great reminder of the founding principles of our nation. Did you know George Washington was afraid of being buried alive? Asked Bake. I didn't know about that, she said. The guy scarcely had a fear except for that one. You knew he freed his slaves. She said. She was eating. He was not. This would not work to his advantage. Nonetheless, he went on. Talk about people who've toiled hard in this country, and yet, not to argue with your thesis too much, those slaves didn't all get ahead. Your man Barama, my friend, would not even be in the running if he wasn't black. Now, all appetite left him entirely. The food on his plate, whatever it was, splotches of taupe, dollops of orange, went abstract like a painting. His blood pressure flew up. He could feel the pulsing twitch in his temple. You know, I never thought about it before, but you're right. Being black really is the fastest, easiest way to get to the White House. She said nothing, and so he added, unless you're going by cab, and then, well, it can slow you down a little. Chewing, Linda looked at him, a flash in her eyes. She swallowed. Well, supposedly, we've already had a black president. We have? Yes, a Nobel Prize-winning author said so. Hey, take it firsthand from me. Don't believe everything that a Nobel Prize winner tells you. I don't think a black president ever gets to become president when his nightclub singer mistress is holding a press conference during the campaign. That would be a white president. Please pass the salt. The shaker appeared before him. He shook some salt around on his plate and stared at it. Linda made a stern, effortful smile, struggling to cut something with her knife. Was it meat? Was it poultry? It was consoling to think that, for a change, the rich had had to pay a pretty penny for their chicken while his was free. But it was not consoling enough. If you don't think I, as a woman, know a thing or two about prejudice, you would be sadly mistaken, Linda said. Hey, it's not that easy being a man either, said Bake. There's all that cash you have to spend on porn, and believe me, that's money you never get back. He then retreated, turned toward his left, toward Susie, and leaned in. Help me, he whispered in her ear. Are you charming the patrons? I fear some object may be thrown. You're supposed to charm the patrons. I know I was trying to, I swear, but she's one of those who keeps referring to Bracco as Barama. He had violated most of Susie's dinner talk rules already. No politics, no religion, no portfolio tips, and unless you see the head crowning, never look at a woman's stomach and ask if she's pregnant. He had learned all these the hard way. But in a year like this one, there was no staying away from certain topics. Get back there, Susie said. The sculptor was tapping Susie on the arm again. He tried once more with Linda Santo, the evil lobbyist. Here's the way I see it, he said, and this I think you'll appreciate. It would be great at long last to have a president in the White House whose last name ends with a vowel. We've never had a president whose last name ended with a vowel, she asked. Well, I don't count Coolidge, he said. You're from what part of Chicago? Well, just outside of Chicago, he said. Where outside? Michigan. Isn't Michigan a long way from Chicago? It is, he said. He could feel the cold air on the skin between his socks and his pant cuffs. When he looked at her hands, they seemed frozen into claws. People talk about the rock-solid sweetness of the heartland, but I have to say, she said, Chicago seems like a city that has taken too much pride in its own criminal activity. I don't think that's true, he said. Or was it? He was trying to give her a chance. What if she was right? Perhaps, he said, we have an unfulfilled streak of mythic hankering, or perhaps we don't live as fearfully as other people do. Now he was just guessing. You wait, my friend, she said. There are some diabolical people eyeing that Sears Tower as we speak. Now he was silent. And if you're in it when it happens, which I hope you're not, but if you are, if you are, if you are, if you're eating lunch at the top or having a meeting down below or whatever it is you may be doing, you will be changed. Because I've been there. I know what it's like to be bombed by terrorists. I was in the Pentagon when they crashed that plane right down into it, and I'll tell you, I was burned alive, but not dead. I was burned alive. It lit me inside. Because of that, I know more than ever what this country is about, my friend. He saw now that her fingernails really were plastic, that the hand really was a dry frozen claw, that the face had seemed intriguingly exotic, had actually been scarred by fire and only partially repaired. He saw now she was cloaked in a courageous and intense hideosity. The hair was beautiful, but now he imagined it was probably a wig. Pity poured through him. He'd never felt so sorry for someone. How could someone have suffered so much? How could someone have come so close to death? So unfairly, so painfully and heroically, and how could he still want to strangle them? You were a lobbyist for the Pentagon, was all he managed to say. Any faux pas? Asked Susie in the cab on the way back to the B&B, where warm cookies would await them by their door and snore strips on their nightstand. Beaucoup faux, said Bake. Beaucoup verboten foes. Uttering my very name was like standing on the table and peeing in a wine glass. What? Oh, please, said Susie. I'm afraid I spoke about politics. He said I couldn't control myself. Bracco is going to win, she said. His daughters will like it here. All will be well. Rest assured. Promise? Promise. He was afraid to say more. He did not know how much time he and Susie might even have left together. And an end game of geriatric speed dating, everyone deaf and looking identical. What? I can't hear you. What? You again? Didn't I just see you? All taking place midst bankruptcy and war might be the real circle of hell he was destined for. Don't ever leave me, he said. Why on earth would I do that? He paused. I'm putting in a request not just for on earth, but for even after that. Okay, she said, and squeezed his meaty thigh. At least he had once liked to think of it as meaty. I fear you will soon discover some completely obvious way to find me less than adequate, he said. You're adequate, she said. I'm adequate enough, he added. She kept her hand there on his leg, and on top of hers he placed his, the one with the wedding ring she had given him, identical to her own. He willed all his love into the very ends of his fingertips, and as his hand clasped hers, he watched the firm, deliberate hydraulics of its knuckles and joints. But she had already turned her head away and was looking out the window steadily the rest of the ride back, showing him only her beautiful hair, which was gold and flashing in the passing street lamps, as if it were something not attached to her at all. That's the end. Thank you.
I just have one. I don't have water.
Such a wonderful reading.
Oh, thank you. You're very kind.
And you have such a beautiful, melodious voice.
Yeah, it puts people right to sleep.
Actually,
there's some in the back, you'll
actually
see.
Actually, no, I think everybody was paying attention.
I once gave a talk about a couple months ago, and a friend of mine afterward came up and said, that was just so brilliant, I couldn't even listen to it. She said, I had to close my eyes and just think of other things. So that can happen. But that's a good
compliment to whip out for people who may be tired and confused and might accept that as a compliment.
I was so blown away. I just had to close my eyes and think of other things.
Well, the work is so, as Louise said, so laugh out loud funny. And this story, the relationship is so beautiful. And the way that the characters listen to themselves and to each other. So that idea of how the audience listens or how people listen to each other seems like a large part of your work. I love them, the way they overhear themselves almost sometimes. And they dwell on a word and they just stay with the word until it reveals something.
Yeah, I think they're grasping and clutching, but that's the condition that they're in. It's a little bit like a play, don't you think?
I think it is a little bit like a play. The dialogue, the interior dialogue and the dialogue is just, you know, so incredible. It did actually remind me while you were reading that Beckett says nothing is funnier than unhappiness. Right. And there's this incredible, you know, this incredible sense of humor, and that brings a balance to this world that you depict. And I did want to ask you, I want to talk a little bit about this story. And as you in the audience feel questions brewing, save them, because at a certain point I'll turn the evening over to some of your questions. And I was struck by one thing that I noticed in, I think, in all of your books, but I'm no Laurie Moore scholar, but you always have these amazing epigraphs
That's my favorite part.
Is it?
Yeah, because I don't have to write them. I can just choose them.
Would you mind reading the ones from, quotes from three wonderful poems? I didn't know Carolyn Squire's work, but I looked it up and just loved it.
She's an English poet.
Yeah.
The first is from Carolyn Squire's poem, An Apple Tree Spouts Philosophy in an Office Car Park. I shall still be here, growing my bark around the wire fence like a grin. And then the second is from Louise Glück's Vita Nova. In the splitting up dream, we were fighting over who would keep the dog, Blizzard. You tell me what that name means. He was a cross between something big and fluffy and a dachshund. Does this have to be the male and female genitalia? Supposing I'm the dog, as in my child self, unconsolable because completely pre-verbal. Oh, Blizzard, be a brave dog. This is all material. You'll wake up in a different world. You will eat again. You will grow up into a poet. Life is very weird, no matter how it ends. Very filled with dreams. And then the last is from Amy Gersler, called Interview with a Dog. And it's just this. Don't be gruff. Anything that falls on the floor is mine. I like the artistic assertion of that Amy Gersler line. So
this is one of your favorite parts of putting together a manuscript, choosing the epigraphs. And were these poems that you were reading while you were writing?
Yeah, I mean, the book is about 10 years of stories, so I do read poetry in a kind of scattershot fashion, but I just loved all those poems, and I noticed certain lines that stood out for me, so...
Yeah, I was looking for what they have in common, and I was thinking they're all absurd but really earthbound in a way.
They're all about some version of bark.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And bark, of course, appears throughout the book mm-hmm. in various manifestations. This description at one point of the brain, and then characters who bark at each other. And so was that like a happy find later where you thought, oh, and I will call it Bark?
Well, when you have a collection of stories, usually the collection gets titled after one of the stories, it would be like, you know, Foes and Other Stories. But that's a lot of pressure on the story that you pick. And yeah. I didn't really feel this had a title story. And I felt like that with other collections, too. My first collection was called Self-Help. That's not the title of any of the stories. My last collection was called Birds of America. That's not the title of any of the stories. So it takes the pressure off any one story. It doesn't have to hold the collection together. It doesn't have to be the title story. The word bark is such a great Anglo-Saxon word. Poets love it. Fiction writers love it. And it does appear in every single story in some fashion, but it probably has appeared in every other story that I've written and every story that anyone on earth has ever written. So it's a word that you'll find in everything. But I pulled it out as a kind of signifier for the whole thing, and I primarily was interested in the animal cry of it.
That's where, when I first saw the title before I'd read it, I was thinking of Howl, and I thought, this is so funny. Lori Moore's version is bark. It's like,
that's right.
Yeah,
it's better than growl.
Also, when I was reading it, I didn't know if you were a dog person or a cat person because of bark, but I think you're more of a cat person.
Can you tell from this book or just from our discussion backstage?
Our brief conversation about cats. But you know, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you that I thought maybe no one had ever asked you, but clearly there is no question that no one has ever asked you. But I'm going to continue to try to find one. Okay, I wanted to ask you about the word rue, R-U-E, because that's a word that seems to come up in a lot of your stories, I noticed. And you have this one.
I like that word.
It's such a great word. I even looked it up. And not on the internet.
There's a famous line in Hamlet where Hamlet's mother... No, it's Ophelia who says this. You must wear your rue with a difference. When she's passing out flowers, and she says that to Gertrude. I think that's right.
Yeah, I think so. And it's also there, like
so
the herb.
It's a pun for Shakespeare, too.
Yeah. Right. So you have it in the story Wings on page 139. You have it in other places here, too, but... There's this one sentence that it's in that I just love, and I don't know if that's a word that you... So it's that section after the first... that after the break on the right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind reading that paragraph? Not to sound bossy, but there's a point to this.
Okay. All right, I think you're in teacher mode and I'm in student mode.
Okay.
I like this.
Perhaps you're getting an A.
Good. And you will get an excellent teaching evaluation. Perhaps everyone had their own way of preparing to die. Life got you ready, life got you sad, and then blood started coming from where it didn't used to come. People revisited the deaths of others, getting ready to meet them in the beyond. Casey herself imagined dying would be full of rue, like flipping through the pages of a clearance catalog, seeing the drastic markdowns on stuff you paid full price for and not gotten that much use from when all was said and done. Though all was never said and done. That was the other part about death.
So, yeah, that dying would be full of rue. So that idea of I also thought of the Hausmann poem, that one, "With rue my heart is laden." Like that idea of rue being like regret and longing and wanting to take something back. You have a line somewhere else that I love so much. You said, "In rue lies learning, and learning lies art."
I wrote that?
Yeah.
Where?
I think it might have been in your talk on TV writing or on watching television. Which
That's the one my friend said. It was just, she had to close her eyes and...
Well, I
that was so brilliant. She had to think of other things.
It was wonderful. It's wonderful. I listened to it, and And I noticed that your characters talk about watching television as well. And just to stray from the book for a moment, what do you have favorite TV shows that you watch?
I really don't watch that much television, and I haven't. Although I have three separate cable bills right now because I'm in transition between homes and locales, and I'm not watching any.
So you don't watch Nashville? You just live there.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. I actually live behind the Dunkin' Donuts in Nashville. If anyone's driving through, stop by, say hello. But I don't watch much television. But I got started in writing about television because of the New York Review of Books, and I had been watching The Wire. This was, I don't know, it would have been about six years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was long after The Wire was already done. I got it on Netflix, I think. Oh, no, that was HBO, so you couldn't get it on Netflix. I guess I must have bought the whole set or something, or got it from the library. I can't remember. But I watched it, and I was just obsessed. It was just a beautiful thing, I thought. And I watched all the commentary, and I just, you know. And I had been in England that same month, and everyone in my English publishing house all knew The Wire. I mean, it was very, very big in England. And when I went to find things that had been written about The Wire, in the American cultural press, The New Yorker, zero. Mm-hmm. The New York Times, tiny. New York Review of Books, zero. Mm-hmm. And the London press, The Guardian, all the papers, mm-hmm. the London Review of Books had a big piece on it. So I said to Bob Silvers, I said, would you like a piece on The Wire? You know, because he said, sure. And he's very open. He's lovely. Mm. And so I wrote about The Wire, you know, because it seemed like literature, not mm-hmm. like, I didn't know that much about television because I wasn't actually allowed to watch television when I was a child. So I approached it, I thought, with fresh eyes, and but also as a piece of literature. And once I did that, then there were requests for writing about other things like Friday Night Lights, which I also watched. And
so now you're the go-to.
Well, they have another go-to person who's much better. They have Daniel Mendelsohn, and he actually knows what he's talking about. I'm the sort of crazy lady they drag in from the street who's going, I don't know, I'm just, this is what it looks like to me. But so I think that's why I'm asked to do it, because I just come in with a no preconceptions.
Well, I actually teach some of your writing on television, because I teach a class called Playwrights on Television. So, and the theory is that this golden age of television has to do with a lot of playwrights being on television. So you're on my syllabus in that sense. But if I taught fiction, you would definitely be on my syllabus. So I was wondering, I know you teach, who's on your syllabus when you're
Oh, I
teaching?
Switch it up.
Oh, you switch it up.
I switch
okay.
it up.
I'm no, like...
Well, right now we're going through the Everyman edition of Alice Munro. This is in an MFA workshop, but every week we read one Alice Munro story, and then we do two student stories, and that fills up the 2.5 hours. And my students have taken to saying, see you in Alice Munro next week. But, you know, the stories are so great. And with graduate students, they really understand Munro. With undergrads, it's they're too young in a way to understand what she's doing.
But it's like Chekhov.
It's a little bit like Chekhov because there's...
30.
You have to be 30, right. Because you have to be able to spin...
It's a very special ring.
Very interesting. You have to be able to sort of turn and look back at life a little bit. You have to have a sense of water under the bridge, you know, which, you know, why should a 19-year-old have that sense? They don't.
And she does, I mean, I love her work too, and there's so much that she does with time.
Oh.
There's, it feels so full. And I noticed, again, I'm no Laurie Moore scholar, but I've read all your books, many of them more than once. And
I feel sorry for you.
You make me laugh.
Oh, well, good.
But it just seems that your relationship with time in this book, and I could be wrong, but it just seems slightly different. It seems more layered, or I was wondering about your relationship with time via your characters, if that makes sense. You're just doing a lot with time, like in the way that poetry will move you forward 10 years and then you go back.
Right. It does move around a little bit, and probably I was inspired by what Alice Munro does in that way. She just goes wherever she wants.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way of throwing things out of sequence chronologically that actually is the sequence emotionally. I forgot about this whole part of the room over here. Hi, how are we doing? So there are ways of taking pivotal, central moments mm-hmm. that are actually early on chronologically and sticking them at the end. The end of a story is really everything. It gives the whole meaning to the story. And mm-hmm. so the end of the story may not be the chronological end. It may be something that the author or the story has to pull from earlier on
mm-hmm.
and end with. You know,
mm-hmm.
and the end will be the center, and it really may literally come from the center, chronologically. So I was moving around in time a little more than I usually do
mm-hmm.
in these stories, but not in the story that I read. That's pretty straightforward.
Although that final image seems timeless in a way, like the hair and the movement.
Yeah, it's still in the cab.
That's true.
In the cab going home.
That story also gets at a lot of these, you know, this. I guess what I'm thinking is that the uncomfortable political conversation that starts happening, that's so resonant, I think, with Louise described this capacity that you have to depict moments that many of us have had, but we haven't even articulated it to ourselves. But this, like, very uncomfortable situation that he is in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just, and I mean, A Gate at the Stairs also has a lot of inflection, but I find all of your work has this, a lot of political subtext and characters sort of struggling through their lives in a certain way, and what's being buffeted in a certain way, and trying to figure out how to what's the right way to respond.
Right. Well, that's, you know, that's the world we live in, and if you're going to be a contemporary, you know, storyteller, you're going to want to sort of pay attention to how these things intersect and what are on particular people's minds, what are on fictional characters' minds, what is on your own mind. It's one of the big mistakes I see my undergraduates doing is that they will write about things that are not on their mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they're off-center. They don't really care about them. It's kind of just some vague idea they had. You really have to write from the center, and when you write from the center, you'll find a lot of things you care about that may not superficially have things in common. But you put them down there and, you know, make a story, and they will talk to each other. So
sometimes in your stories, and I love that description because it's almost like there's this idea of what's the right thing to write about versus what you secretly are interested in. It's like your public persona or desires and your secret desires, and you seem to be able to articulate those for a wide range of characters. And sometimes you have these little vignettes, well, often it seems to me like stories within a story within a story, and just these paragraphs that I feel like could be lifted out and be their own stories.
Oh, that's so interesting. I don't think that I do have that, but I say that's interesting because The course I'm trying to sort of devise for next fall is about the story within a story, and the number of stories I'm thinking of. I mean, there's some great Toby Wolfe stories. There's Alice Munro's stories that have stories mm-hmm. within stories. Mm-hmm. And oops, just bumped into my own microphone. Are we okay? I'm looking at the okay. But I never thought that I had actually written one.
I think there's one instance of this on page 107. And maybe I'm using the word story too broadly. I mean, they're almost asides, like sotto voces for a character, where they have a memory or an association or a digression that's so interesting that it seems like that could be its whole other world to go into. And so just the hospice care, the hospice care, it's never too soon to call, read a billboard. That section, do you see that? Okay, wait, let me find
that
another
one. That was an actual billboard in that.
Oh, was it?
You can't make this stuff up. You just have to write it down. But you can't make it up. It's never too soon. Hospice care, it's never too soon to call. Huge billboard.
And then next to it, a traffic sign read, "Pass with care." Surrealism could not be made up. It was the very electricity of the real. That, like, to me, that could be its own very own thing. But there's the part where you talk about going to a diner. The character remembers going to Casey goes to a diner, and she remembers how once she asks for soy milk, all endearments will cease. Like, it just seems like that could be its own story. And I guess I feel that throughout. There's something about the shape. Maybe it's the shape of your paragraphs that sometimes seem to contain a whole nutshell of a narrative that gives us insight in a different dimension.
Well, this story, which is called Wings, is about two falling apart musicians. Their band has fallen apart, and they're falling apart. But there's lots of backstory.
Yeah.
So that story, I mean, they have a lot of history, and they're about, you know, I won't tell you that they're about to break up, but because you knew that anyway. but so there's references to their past together, and their separate paths, mm-hmm. including mm-hmm. his and Swaziland. It sort of quickly dives into the past and then moves things along in the storytelling present.
And what interests you about that course of the story within the story, which I think that you're doing?
I don't think I'm really doing story within this. Not
or stories or potentials. Maybe also I see it in anagrams, where there's like a potential for stories to go different ways.
Oh, well, that...
Yeah, that, which is a different thing.
Right, and that was just trying to express that. That was trying to express the idea that as soon as you have an idea, another idea sort of rearranges itself and hatches itself out of it. And so I thought, I'll just record all that and make that the structure of the book. But the stories within stories would be more like the... well, like Ray Carver, what we talk about when we talk about...
Yeah.
Where people are sort of caught, and then one person is telling a story to another person. And the story that is being told by one person has some mm-hmm. reference mm-hmm. to the outside story.
Oh, I see. Okay.
In the Albanian Virgin.
Yeah.
There's that Albanian Virgin story mm-hmm. that's being told to the first-person narrator... who doesn't know whether it's true or not. Mm-hmm. But it has some bearing on the listener's life mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, so it's like a play within a play.
Yeah, you're going to have to help me with my course.
I'm, yeah.
trying to.
Well, I don't know
it.
About that one,
I
but
have
I am.
To order the books by next week, so I've been making jotting down titles and things.
I always end up ordering the books for my students, as many of you know, because I can never figure out. What
I
I'm
know.
Teach,
but, yeah. I know.
It's hard.
April's
There's so much out there.
Early.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you probably have some questions brewing. So while the mic is going around, I do have another question here.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to talk about this, but a few years ago.
I don't like the sounds
Mike.
Of that already.
Okay. Let's see if anyone has a question, then this will be a sort of backup.
Hi. My question is prefaced on items that I've read in the newspaper about. Uh-oh. Sometime in March, there was an article in the LA Weekly about the discontinuation of a writing class at USC. There was also another article where one of the earthquakes we had recently on a Monday, the news, LA Times, it was written by a robot.
Oh, my God.
Okay. And I've heard in on news things that robots are being programmed to even teach classes like yours. So my question is based on these little tidbits picked up in news stories. Are you concerned about the state of writing, creative, whether it's report writing, creative writing, or whatever? Are you have any concerns with the future of writing, creative writing?
Well, yeah, we all do. We all do. And, you know, in terms of teaching in the humanities or teaching in the arts or teaching anywhere, there's already been a lot of online, you know, teaching, and there's an ongoing conversation in academe about this. Are we putting ourselves out of jobs? Are we extending, you know, things? Are we shrinking them? This and that. The robot thing has not yet come up, but it's destined to. You know, there is a way in which people can just teach themselves to write, but the idea for writing courses and programs is that the students really want another, you know, they want a couple warm bodies in the room. And so the robot wouldn't really fulfill that. Technology is very scary. I got, my computer was breaking down, and so I got a tiny little small computer to travel with, to come out here to the West Coast. I could just stick it in my carry-on and go. And I brought it home, and I had both computers turned on at the same time, and one of the computers came on and said, "You have another computer in this room." It was like a jealous spouse. And then it shut down, and it said, you know, my computer back, so I'm traveling with the new girlfriend, whereas, because the other one is having a fit, because I haven't, you know. But how did that one computer know I had another computer? I have no idea. How did it know that? Scary. It's scary. Yeah. But thank you. I share your concern, especially in journalism. I think this is going, you know, machine-generated stories, yeah, that's probably going to happen. And it's already happening, as you say. It's not good. It's not good.
Next question, right up here. Thank you.
Beautiful reading. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I have I'm making tenuous connection between something you said about your love of the ending in story and something that I love so much about your work, the mordant wit, as Louise said, the satire. And often, Bake, especially in dialogue, Bake in dialogue, even in this story, the art of the punchline or the one-liner or the kind of rounding and changing of the story in the epiphanic moment. I wonder if your love of the ending is tied into your sense of comedy and the ear for that. Mm. I don't know.
I mean, I think the ending is, it's not a personal love of the ending. It actually is just how the genre of a short story has to work. I would call it a form, and to the extent that it's end-oriented, you could perhaps refer to it as a form, because you are talking about the shape of it and not just the category of it. But the ending of a short story is more important than the ending of a novel. It's not just a personal preference. The ending of a novel sort of concludes the energies and looks forward to, and somehow you have a sense of how these people are, you know, what's going to happen to them afterward because everything important has already occurred. But the ending of a short story spins and looks back over the short story and gives, so it's more retrospective in a way, which is why I think it's interesting to take pivotal moments from the center, place them at the end, and the irony of that being the ending, that the conclusion of the story actually, you know, had sort of appeared at the beginning, unbeknownst to, you know, the characters, is interesting. So I don't think of it as a personal love of the ending. I don't mean to quarrel with your phrasing, but even though I do have a personal love of endings, but it just belongs generally to the art and craft of the short story. Yeah.
Thank you. So if I may ask you to play devil's advocate for a second against MFA programs. Mm-hmm. I actually have an MFA, and I'm still coming to terms with it 7 years after, I think, getting it.
Well,
I think one of the best things was having found you and Alice Munro, like, in it. So I have very positive things to say about it. And then I'm also just still very curious about how the whole thing is affected.
It's just a cafe. Maybe, you know, don't tell the chancellor at Vanderbilt I said this. It's a cafe where you come together and you talk about literature and writing and you compare notes. And if you have another cafe where you can do that, you can do it there. You should never go into debt. Never go into debt for it. Is that the problem, that you went into debt? For an MFA?
My three good poems I've written are great.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to make you feel bad. I just don't feel people should. I mean, if you have a rich aunt or something who doesn't have anything to do with her money and says, you know, get her to pay for it, but taking out loans for an MFA, no, don't do it. There are many good programs that are either inexpensive or, you know, long distance. You know, you can do it long distance. They're low residency. Or they fund you completely. Wisconsin funds you completely. Vanderbilt funds you completely. Cornell funds you completely. Texas funds you completely. Michigan funds you completely. You know, that's how you do it. But unless you're rich, if you're rich, you know, you can go to NYU. I mean, NYU has... I taught at NYU last spring, and the students all... I mean, a lot... They were either rich... Or they all were madly working at jobs and commuting in and this and that. They were great students. I loved them. But the financial situation, because NYU hasn't yet figured out that. I think they feel they don't have to because they have this New York City faculty and they're in the city and they're going to get students no matter what. But I had people who were full-time teachers who would... you know, come to the class after their full day of teaching eighth grade. And they would come to my class at 6 o'clock. And they were paying for it that way. I was a visitor. In general, if I were part of a program like that, I would work very hard to have the finances changed. And I think everyone does try to some extent. There is this idea that some people will cling to that, you know, if the student doesn't pour money into it, they won't write as well. Which, you laugh, right? You know, it's right that they have to invest in it that way. I don't believe that. I mean, you're investing in terms of time, and you're investing in terms of relocating or doing, you know, all kinds of other things. But no, I find it a lot. Student loans I find alarming because they're so enormous now. Now, I went to Cornell which paid for everything, but I did take out a student loan because I had no spending money, not really. So I took out a loan for $5,000. Now, that was a long time ago because I'm very old. But it still was less than what... I mean, it still was easy to pay off eventually, and it didn't burden me or frighten me. Okay, you're doing well. You must have a good-paying job. Yeah, for you. Well, okay.
I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, could you talk about some of the, just becoming a writer, the authors or poets or short story writers who inspired you growing up and who you read and just beginning?
Oh, I didn't write seriously until I was probably in my late teens, but I was always reading whatever. I read garbage. I read Perry Mason, you know, Case of the Grinning Gorilla. I love that book. But I also read literary things, and in college, I think, you know, my freshman year when I was 17, I started reading Shakespeare in a serious way for the first time. Loved, loved, loved it. Had a great Shakespeare professor. And that was kind of formative for me because I was also starting to write seriously then. Before that, I would really read anything, you know. Sometimes, because this was before the age of internet porn, which, you know, I learn about from my students. They all know all about it, and they're surprised I know nothing. But there was a way in which reading books for a young teenager was a way of learning about the adult world of sex and romance and affairs. And, you know, so you'd read things, you know, and you'd read page 27 of The Godfather over and over again. Like, whoa. I mean, reading was a way of, you know, it was sex education, basically. Reading had many, many purposes. It wasn't just about, you know, building up your skills as a writer. In fact, I didn't really know I would become a writer until later on. I mean, maybe in my 20s. But I did know that I loved the arts, and I loved music, I loved theater, I loved to read, I loved so many things. I just found myself deeply moved and stirred by almost everything in the arts. I also loved science writing, loved to read science writing. And good and well-written science writing is just terrific. You know, Natalie Angier and Gina Colotta can do it well. It's just a mishmash. I haven't, you know, I think my favorite book when I was four was The Wizard of Oz, which is very different from the movie. It has all these different characters and different things in it. But I love that book. So thank you all for coming.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.